Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Hobo Thinga podcast. My name is Crystal Cedino, and I am the Training and Development Manager for the Native Learning Center. Really thrilled that all of you are tuning in for another episode. With me today is my right-hand lady, Cora. Go ahead and introduce yourself, Cora.
Good morning, everyone. I'm Cora Anthony, the Training and Development Specialist here at the Native Learning Center.
Thank you. And with us, we have some special guests, returning and new. We always love new. We always love returning. But I think today's exciting. So with that, let me go ahead and introduce everyone. So we have Dr. Cynthia Nett, a Research Associate Professor at KSU, and a Data and Mapping Maven, who is also a Google Earth Outreach Network Trainer. And then we have Eugene Goldfarb, an adjunct professor at University of Illinois Chicago, who's retired after 30 years with HUD and has been a longtime NLC instructor, and who just went out last week too. Just thought I'd throw that out. And then last but not least, we have Jennifer Clancy, who is the TAB coordinator for Region 7, but is also part of KSU's tribal TAB team. So go ahead and say hi, Jennifer, introduce yourself, and let's see what we're going to be discussing today.
All right. Hi, everyone. Thanks, Crystal and Cora, for having me join you today. As Crystal said, I'm Jennifer Clancy. I'm with the KSU TAB and Tribal TAB team. But I have a pretty, obviously a bigger background than just that. I've done a little bit of everything related to environmental and brownfields. I started out in environmental consulting before moving into local government. And so I've worked at a couple of local government levels, including most recently, I managed the brownfields program for the city of Houston, which is actually how I got introduced to TAB. They helped me out quite a bit, when I was running that program and working with communities there. So I'm thrilled to be here.
Thank you so much. All right, so today's topic, for those that are wondering, because we've done actually a few episodes with Eugene and Cynthia and a few others who are not here today, which is totally okay. Like Mark, we miss Mark.
But, he's playing with animals today.
There we go. But with that, today we're going to be discussing brownfields planning for community resilience. And I'm intrigued. Can we get some context on what exactly all of that entails? Anyone?
Well, we really were excited to bring Jen on. For those of you who have listened to some of our previous podcasts, you might remember that Scott Nightingale, who also works with us, he's the co-director of Tribal TAB, outlined in a very formal fashion what the brownfields process is. And we've talked about that several times, but we wanted to bring Jen in because she has a more expansive view of what this can do for communities and some different ways of looking at brownfields that I think will be really useful taking us into the future.
Wonderful, thank you. All right, so let's go ahead and just jump into our first question then. Just get the ball rolling. So when you talk about brownfields within a community, do you think about each site on the inventory as a separate project, or how do you think about all the sites, on inventory? Is it more of a holistic approach, or is there a more holistic approach? Anyone?
Yeah, so I am a big believer in what I consider a holistic approach. I don't know how everyone else thinks about it, but there's been this sort of historic view or approach of working with brownfields where it's just like, okay, I've got this site and it needs to be redeveloped, so here's the thing, let's do the assessments, go through the technical stuff, and then okay, let's just redevelop it, and like, that's great. There's nothing, there's a lot of success that goes behind that. What I like to then kind of carry forward is, whether it is that one site or a grouping of sites or whatever, thinking about it in a broader context of like, what will this do for the community, right? What does the community need? Who does the community want to be? Where are we trying to take ourselves and move in the future? And how can this help us? So it's taking a step back and looking at, our community as a whole, and how, again, whether it's just this one site or a grouping of sites, what they can really do for the community as a whole, helping to move forward and be the best version of themselves that they can be.
Could I piggyback on that? There's a tendency to think, like Jen's saying, of just in America, the private sector will do everything. And, oh, here's a parcel of land. Somebody will take it and they'll redevelop it. And even where Jen spent a lot of her time in Houston, that's famous around the country for having no zoning, no real planning. But most governments have realized the value of planning, the value of having a vision for the community. This is, and one of the things at TAB that we do in a lot of communities, the first thing that we say, oh, have we have a visioning workshop to have the community decide, you know, what, share the vision to mobilize resources. But I think what Jen's saying is that even before you have the meeting on that particular site, the community as a whole, that's what planning really is all about. If you have a plan for the community, it's people are sharing a vision and they're saying, what resources do we have to mobilize to implement that vision?
Right, exactly. And to, again, sort of to expand on that a little bit, in case it wasn't clear from what Eugene was saying, which it may have been, the community voice is what is the most important piece of this particular process. So it's, you know, planning, but I'm not a planner. I want to start with that. I'm not a planner. So while I'm talking about planning, I'm not in a, you know, in a quote planning, I'm not a planner, right? But giving, so when I'm talking about planning, I'm just sort of thinking more about like forward thinking, right? But going back to kind of what Eugene was touching on, before you can really get, as the community at large can really, you know, here's our plan, you know, we're putting this plan together, you know, whatever the case may be, getting the participatory input from the community itself so that what is happening is actually community driven and not just whoever is in charge or in a place of authority saying, this is what we think this community should be like. This is what we think the community wants. Before you even get to that, taking that step back to hear from the community itself, who are we, where do we want to go, who do we see ourselves, what do we want, those sorts of things.
Yeah, in the first half of the 20th century, when people said planning, it was like philosopher kings, like Robert Moses in New York. Oh, I know best how to plan all the expressways and the municipal structures and doing it. And there was like almost like a revolution. Jane Jacobs wrote The Death and Life of Great American Cities, I think it was in 61. And then she fought with Robert Moses. And although that's a city, it's the same principle wherever you go, that if you really want to get the community behind you, if you really want a bunch of local experts who have lived in this area for years and years, you talk to the community. And the vision should really, sure, there's on the top, but most of the vision should be coming from the bottom up rather than the top down.
Yeah, exactly.
And you know, this sounds self-evident, you know, especially for this group and for our listeners. But just yesterday, I was talking to a colleague who was frustrated because her city brought in a group of very skilled engineers from Europe who had never worked with a community like hers. And they were particularly skilled with managing water, but had no idea what this particular community was. And so that one size fits all top-down planning is still occurring in a lot of places.
Definitely. I can see that. I mean, having worked with tribes, you know, because I mean, that's specifically where we're headed. I know that you can't just walk into a community and be like, I know how to do this, and we're going to do this, and this is what's going to happen. That is not going to go over well by any means. And I mean, I'm not specifically from a tribe, but that wouldn't go over with me as a normal human being. So why would you think that you could just, you know, step into a community and just kind of like bum, 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 you know, this is what we're going to do. So,
right. Yeah. Here I am. I know everything. That's
right.
No, you're exactly right. And we do get too comfortable in that role, regardless of the type of community that we're working in. I think that we, you know, that sort of the collective, we get too comfortable sort of falling into that role. And I think it's very, very important that we kind of all remember that, to take a step back and really listen, hear what's going on, spoken and unspoken, and don't just react and respond, you know, kind of internalize and let stuff roll around and, you know,
before
you start talking, you know.
No, especially with brownfields. Brownfields are properties that the private sector are not developing. They're just sitting there stuck. Nothing's happening for years and years. And we realize that we got to get more resources. We got to get people, stakeholders in the community, either citizen or business interests, the government, to do something. And people are only going to do something if they want to, if they really believe in it. That's why we all have to share the vision of what this property can become in order to take steps in that direction. It's not going to happen overnight, but we got to all be walking in the same direction.
You know, Eugene, you kind of bring up a good point there, because in some ways, with the brownfields, it's about changing people's minds. And when you said stuck property and getting everybody to have a shared vision, you know, sometimes it's people have an idea already about that property and they need to have a process through which they can change their minds about what that property can become. I always love the way Jen talks about it, because she brings in terms like healing, and she brings in a lot of terms about, you know, reconciliation kind of thinking, that there may be past trauma associated with this property. There may be ways that people are thinking about this property that is keeping it stuck. And if you're not dealing with those emotions and those ideas that they have now, the current vision of that property, if you don't engage with that, then you're not going to change their minds about it. Jen, there's a great example that you were just telling me about with a dorm from one of the BIA schools.
Yeah, so you know, without going way into that whole project and that whole effort, we did this sort of short documentary film on the cleanup efforts at, as you know, the broad context was the cleanup efforts at this old boarding school, but obviously there's way more to the story than just that. But I had the opportunity for the first time to watch this in a non-brownfields audience, which, you know, we get in our little blinders and, you know, this is just how we think about stuff. And, you know, when we started that project, you know, Cynthia mentioned this, you know, this kind of idea of healing and thinking about the power that brownfields properties can actually have within a community. And that became really evident, again, watching this with this audience, because there was this tone. An audience member brought up family members that had been forced to boarding schools, and you know what that does to the community, to the family, for generations. I mean, all of that. But that creating this sort of very hopeful tone sets the stage that can allow them to start to move in a direction of healing. It was a very powerful thing to actually witness, to see that, you know, these ideas that we have, that we talk about behind the scenes, that we think, that they actually do translate across the spectrum of people and communities. So yeah, anyway.
And that's a good example that the boarding school like that, which is a dark mark on our history, there'd be a tendency in a brownfield to, oh, let's redevelop it, then let's put something there and we'll forget about it. But if we do visioning, if we hear from people, we may hear saying, we don't want to forget about this. This is really important. And let's make sure that whatever we develop this brownfield, you know, let's remember our lesson and let's not repeat it.
Exactly.
Definitely. I think Cora has a really good question on reframing. So Cora, why don't you go ahead and jump in?
Well, I was actually going to move to, because I'm interested in knowing about the history. I think Cynthia really explained that when she said about kind of looking, instead of looking at brownfields like a liability or a block to progress, but kind of seeing it as a healing, and in how Jen kind of explains that. So I really just wanted to get you guys' perspective on, so how can the community, like their history, their values, be brought into this brownfield process to be part of that healing and kind of reframing of the way people look at it? And how can they, or is there a way for them to include like specific traditions, values, and goals of a community into the planning?
Yeah, I mean, so the short answer, yes, absolutely. I've been trying to get for years, I think people are finally starting to bite on this, but I've been trying to, for the last several years, get people to think about brownfields as, because there's always such a negative association with them, right? They're, oh, these things that we're just stuck with and we have to, can't do anything with them, or we have to figure out, it's this big hurdle. And so, kind of the flipping the narrative. That's what I like. Flipping the brownfields narrative is kind of how I like to think about it. And so these things that are commonly viewed as challenges and obstacles, well, let's flip that, and let's turn these into opportunities for the community to, again, what is this version of ourselves that we want to be? What do we want to hold on to? What do we want to remember? What do we want to carry forward? How do we thrive? You know, all these sort of like large questions that people are always trying to answer. How can you use these things that you for so long have just been like, ugh, so how do you use those to help you, grow and, move into this realm that you're trying to move into? But even thinking through in communities, how did those brownfields get there in the first place? And, I've worked with a lot of communities in Houston, a lot of, separate smaller neighborhoods in there. And that was really kind of where part of this thought process started to develop, because, really digging into the history and the community stories there, and learning that, all these environmental legacies are left over from legal segregation, without getting into the whole, that's where these are stemming from in a lot of instances in those particular contexts. And, so when you start to take a step back from that and put that, question that in every other kind of community, tribal, non-tribal, urban, rural, whatever, where are these environmental issues, these brownfields, the environmental legacies, where are they stemming from? What does that tell you about the history of the community? Where they've been, what has happened, and then how do you, it's at that point, then it becomes more than just, all right, we're going to clean this up and we're going to redevelop it, right? That's when you can start to get into this. I feel like healing, so that's a very powerful word, right? But that, so not to simplify that idea at all, but that's where you can kind of start to get into some of these bigger thoughts and ideas for the community is, how did we get here? Where are these issues stemming from? And what do we want to change? What do we want to remember? The remembering piece is a real important piece, because we don't want to repeat anything that we've been through, but we don't want to forget it either.
And I always like when you talk about thriving, that community shouldn't just be surviving.
Right, right. It's not enough to just survive. That's, this larger context of resilience. That's one of these words that just gets thrown around willy-nilly these days. So it's like when you say planning, eyes kind of start to glaze over. I feel like that sort of starts to happen these days when you talk about resilience, eyes glaze over. But it's more than, I feel like there's, in a lot of contexts, it is just like, we are resilient because we're surviving, and but I think that there's so much more to that, that you want your people, your community, the collective self to thrive. It's not just enough to survive, right? You want to thrive at the individual level and at the collective level.
Yeah, let me also say that you know, the fact that EPA is involved is a quirk. And I think we've discussed that in another podcast, that site contamination, sure, these brownfields may or may not be contaminated, and that may complicate the recovery, the getting it back to being a good neighborhood. But is, I think Jen's pointing out, that's not the real story. The real story is that these neighborhoods don't work anymore for a variety of reasons. It could be a natural evolution. It could be discrimination, that the banks wouldn't lend in these areas because of their demographics. And that's been documented. But what we really have to do is we have to think about, you know, what did this neighbor used to do? And gee, that probably doesn't exist anymore. That was 100 years ago when the neighborhood was first developed. But what can this neighborhood do in the future? And what would be important components of that? And once we do that and we think about, you know, what type of uses would be there, then we start thinking about, well, how do we do this? How do we clean it up? How do we get the funding? And it's a complicated process, but what do they say? A journey of 1,000 miles starts with a few small steps. I also don't want to forget that if we look at the preservationists, historic preservation, that's actually a good model for us, because what do preservationists do? They say, here's a building that was built 75, 100 years ago, and yeah, it's functionally obsolete now. The way that was designed carefully by architects to function, we don't live that way anymore. But preservationists are very good at adaptive reuse. That how do we take this old building, how do we reposition, how do we give it modern plumbing, modern electricity, modern HVAC, and then how do we take that space and use it in something that makes sense today? And if we do that, we could get tax credits and all sorts of stuff, and we get a really neat old building that not only functions today, but reminds us of the history of our town, our village, our location, our neighborhood.
One thing that we often hear in a tribal brownfields context is the need to not buy in too much to the concept of progress in terms of, you know, leading to things in some places like gentrification, things of that sort, but to look at the different values. And I think one of the things that Eugene is mentioning is that really looking at something in terms of the value in this particular context of its history, and not necessarily in terms of you know, making it a tourist destination or anything, but perhaps you know, the context for the brownfields is this is a berry patch. You know, we always like to talk about berry patches, and this could be a access to an important historic fishing site. Mm-hmm. You know, there are reasons why these sites have value other than economic development. It may not be something that a university archaeologist would say this has cultural meaning because there's artifacts here or something like that, but the location may have a long history with a story, and that story is what needs to be preserved.
Right.
And the preservation and the redevelopment has to be within the context of that story.
Yeah, that's a really excellent point. And it kind of, you know, goes back to this, something I feel like we've been, I don't want to say fighting because that's too powerful, up against, you know, running into walls against, maybe with, you know, I don't want to single out the EPA, but because I, you know, I'm a big fan. But again, this brownfields historically has been about economic development. That's the whole thing. You know, it's not a success unless it creates jobs and brings money into the community and all these sorts of things. And okay, sure. But if you're looking at brownfields from a perspective of, you know, what is the ultimate and best reuse for the community, which is the context in which you're supposed to be thinking about this. What is the ultimate, highest and best reuse for the community? That is not always going to be these traditional models of redevelopment and economic stimulation and things like that. And so especially I feel like or the same path. The same path won't necessarily work to get there if economic development is the choice. But I feel like this becomes really apparent in tribal communities. And so one thing that we have been sort of up against, I think, is getting the funders to accept, and this is going back to what Cynthia was saying, I'm tying this back in, I promise, that restoration can be, you know, preservation and restoration can be a perfectly acceptable highest and best reuse for the community. You know, redevelopment doesn't have to be the highest and best reuse, but that, you know, perhaps it is, you know, we want to restore and preserve this area where this plant used to grow because this is very significant to our culture and to our community, and we want to bring that back. So it's, again, it's this sort of changing this narrative. It's not just about how communities think about brownfields, but also how we are getting everyone, even the funders, to reconsider the power behind these things and when what is actually, quote, highest and best reuse. And there's not just a blanket response for that.
Could I talk a little bit about that? I mean, I agree 100% with what you're saying, but it still has to be viewed within the broader context. The broader context is, first of all, when EPA is giving out money in this grants competition, they like seeing lots of other money leveraged, and those will score higher. And you really don't get that when you're restoring. So you really have more of a burden to convince EPA how important it is. Not that it can't be done, but you really got to convince them, yeah, this is really important, even though we don't have all sorts of funding with it. In addition, it's not just with tribes, there's more community living and the community has values. So mm-hmm. even if it's envisioned, we're going to set this up or restore it to the old use, we're not going to charge money. It's still very important to the community, but there has to be somewhere expressing that. And finally, I want to say that, you know, money is a metaphor. It's a way our society says this has a lot of value, though. Lots of people want us or are willing to spend money. And when we're talking about doing something with a brownfield, first of all, we have to come up with the money to do it, to either clear it or build the new thing. And that's one challenge. But equally important is operation and maintenance. Mm-hmm. Is there people going to use this site and are they going to take care of it? And either that's charging a user fee or having a store sell something, or it's a public organization like the tribe saying, yes, we're going to maintain this, like a park district accepting a park, we're going to maintain the park. If you don't have that, then why should EPA develop a park if nobody's going to maintain it?
Yeah, and luckily we're moving into an era where younger people like Jen are thinking about this in terms of, I don't mean to speak for you, Jen, but for a lot of my younger colleagues, they're thinking about the economics more broadly. So for example, if you have a community that is suffering from many different health problems and mental health problems, intergenerational trauma can lead, I'm a biologist, I'm sorry, I'm going to use a few terms, they can lead to epigenetic effects, they can lead to psychological effects, they can lead to problems with social trauma, they can lead to dropout rates in schools. All of those things, all of those health effects and emotional effects drag down an economy. So if we look at community in a broader economic model where we're bringing in these non-traditional indicators. So we're asking, what is the money that's being spent on incarceration, the money being spent on lack of advancement in schools, the money that's being spent on the additional health problems, the money being spent on homelessness? Those are all economic drags on a community. Now, if a culture for a particular town, community, if that culture would allow it to use the restoration of a green space, say, not just a park, but a green space in some sense of the word. Or I've seen this in my own community as we've cleaned up the Kansas River. You know, as we do some of these environmental restorations, the access to the natural world can actually improve health outcomes and can actually improve a community's ability to move forward economically. So if we can restate, and so this is going to take, like Eugene's exactly right, this takes a lot more work, but if we can restate the economic value of healing a location in terms of healing that community, in terms of advancing the economy, because the human capital can increase, then we might need to change those narratives.
Right. And you know, there's starting to be, I don't know any off the top of my head, but there are starting to be more of these, the cost benefit calculator type things that are out there that do take these other types of, the human aspect of what is going on into account. So you can maybe start to get, if you have to talk about things in economic terms, you can start to get a dollar number to assign to, you know, this is what, this not having access to this thing, whatever, you know, speaking very generally, what this is costing the community, what not having adequate healthcare, not having, you know, parks to play, green space, you know, whatever the case may be. They're developing these sort of economic calculators that allow you to take some of those things into account as we move forward. And, you know, because that's going to become even more relevant as we continue to, have our little fight against climate change, right? Like there's a huge cost for inaction. And so I think some of these calculators allow you to sort of take some of that. Well, what's the cost of inaction in a dollar amount, you know, that you can start to put in your EPA application or whatever the case may be.
Okay, I know I'm being redundant, but I want to emphasize, and this is even redundant with other of our episodes, is that like Jen saying, oh, you could put a value on this, you could look at this, you could look at that. But don't forget, it's the local government that decides what's important in which brownfields to choose and what do with them. On one hand, EPA decides which projects to fund, but EPA doesn't invent the projects. The projects are proposed locally, and they're proposed, but usually the local government's involved, and they're doing it because these are the values of our community. This is what's important to us, and therefore this project is important. And sure, it helps to put those in dollars and cents, but on a visceral level, people know what's important in their community, what they want to see. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Sorry, Crystal. I wanted to quickly ask because I'm getting all this information, and I thank you guys for putting into context what community thriving is going to look like, right, and feel like and whatnot. So how does Tribal Tab support Native communities in their efforts to think about brownfields, as you've described it, holistically and building that community resilience?
Like on one hand, we're generally called in from that they have a property and they know it's a brownfield. And, you know, how could you help us figure out how contaminated it is? How could you help us figure out where to get funding? How could you help us have a community visioning to see what the community wants? But at the same time, there's the recognition that we have to look at it holistically. And Jen's been working with some of our TAP partners in New Mexico that have a very interesting approach to for tribal long-range planning.
Yeah, so there's actually two elements that I want to touch on related to that. I'll get to, well, I guess technically all of these partners are in New Mexico, but separate sets of partners. So I'll circle back to specifically, I think, what Eugene was talking about. But before we were able to get to that point, I was working with one of our other Tribal Tab partners who used to be the director of Tribal Tab. And he and I had this sort of vision of wanting to create these, we were just thinking about them as resilience principles, Brownfields resilience principles that were specific to tribal communities. And this is stemming from a whole other, you know, set of stuff of, you know, articles that we'd read and experiences that I had in my own work and observations that he and I had both made while watching and working with tribal communities. So we sort of set out to, that was kind of the start of this, thinking about tribal brownfields as a mechanism for thinking about community resilience, right? So he and I set out to sort of create these principles and this framework. And again, it boils back to this holistic community-wide participatory thing. I mean, that's a, you know, big important component. But we're sort of setting the stage for what we'd hope to do was create like a planning framework that would take all this into some kind of context and allow you to think about brownfields again, whole community, not just this one isolated site. Think about it in this context of, you know, thriving communities, growing communities, not just status quo. You know, how do you, you know, you got a lot of communities where like everybody's just sort of barely keeping their head above water. How do you get their whole bodies out of water? You know, we gotta literally and metaphorically, I suppose we're talking about these days, so he and I started working on this, came up with these seven principles, which I won't go into all of that, but that was sort of.
And this is Oral Salters you're talking about.
Right, yeah. Right. Oral Salters, sorry. Former director of Tribal Tab and,
you know, everyone loves Oral.
Yeah, very close friend, very wonderful colleague. We collaborate on a lot of this stuff. So Oral and I really sat down and put a lot of thought into these sort of guiding principles and how these could be used to think about brownfields, with the ultimate goal of creating planning framework. Like that's another one of those things that makes people's eyes glass over when you talk about it, but something tangible that the communities could use to help themselves. And so then enter the Indigenous Design and Planning Institute at University of New Mexico. And we've been working with them over the last, you know, couple years on several things, but what has kind of all fallen out of that is this places toolkit that we've developed, which I think in my head becomes the sort of planning framework for this larger, you know, tribal brownfields resilience initiative. But the places toolkit looks at, so it's an acronym, obviously, population. So where is the population now? Where has it been? How do you think it's going to go? And that helps you think about what is the community, what is the future need for the community, right? Land use, you know, how is land generally being used in the community? Assets, what are your community assets? Community itself, community engagement, that's the C, empowerment, and storytelling. And so putting all these elements together creates with the overview of these resilience principles that Oral and I have been working on, kind of creates the mechanism in which tribal communities can start to, again, plan for their future selves. What's the direction that they want to be moving in? But because this was put together by the Indigenous Design and Planning Institute, these tools, they have they put this Indigenous perspective on what are traditional sort of Western Anglo planning approaches. And it really I mean, it changes the whole discussion, I think, at that point. So we've been really excited to, I don't know about everyone else, I've been very excited to be working with them over the past couple of years and not only learn from them, but to be able to take, you know, what build on their knowledge and bring it directly into Brownfields and the work that we're doing at Tribal Tab, and then help us expand on this sort of larger Tribal Brownfields Resilience Initiative that we've been working on.
Beautiful.
I just want to talk about when we talk, we've been using the word resilience, and just to make sure we're all hearing the same thing, that there's the dictionary definition of resilience is the capacity to recover quickly from difficulties, toughness. And most of us, when, or at least in the broader society, and especially FEMA, FEMA has a lot of money out there, and they're talking about resilience and will help you do resilience planning. They're talking more about natural, like floodplains or earthquakes and stuff like that. And traditionally, when we talk about economic resiliency, we're talking about something that hits us all at once and we want to quickly recover. And resilience is the right word, that we want to recover in a lot of our tribal areas, but it didn't happen yesterday. It's more like a long story, you know, like this happened a long time. And realistically, looking at the recovery is going to take a long time to get it back to where we want it to be. So it's still a question of resilience. We don't want to build something for just today. We want to build it for a strong community going forward, but it's not going to be quick. It's took a long time to get here, and it's not going to be quick to recover. But if we move in different directions, we'll never recover. If we talk among ourselves and agree, here's the vision, let's move in that direction, we have more of a chance.
Yeah, that's a great point, Eugene. That distinction between, you know, this abrupt, you know, this, what I think of it as acute and chronic, right? You've got an acute stressor, right? The tornado or the hurricane or, you know, whatever event often associated with climate. But then you have these chronic things that have happened in communities for generations after generations, that do need to be addressed. To me, you know, and this kind of goes back to that, how do you get communities to thrive? And thinking about, you know, we immediately jump into this. All right, again, back to this, I'm picking on economic development. It's a very important thing. I don't want to diminish that at all. But like, all right, we need jobs. We need, you know, investors. We need all totally important. However, if the community cannot even, you know, if they don't have shelter, if they don't have food, if they don't have water, if the community's most basic needs are not being adequately and consistently met, they can't really start to get on board for, you know, all right, let's build this huge development that's gonna, you know, whatever it's gonna do. So I think part of resilience and resilience thinking and resilience planning is, you know, starting with the people themselves and addressing, you know, some of these basic needs that need to be touched on in so many communities.
Yeah, for example, it obviously one of the communities that I work in, they have a big development. There's lots of jobs. There is no public transportation, and the people who need the jobs are too far away to walk. Mm-hmm. And they can't afford a car because they don't have a job. Right. So unless you put in that public transportation, those jobs aren't available. They right. have to be available. So you have to take care of those needs.
Right. Or the flip, the other example of that is you have a community that desperately needs jobs. So you attract whatever, some large, whatever kind of firm to come in and great, now we've got jobs. But those jobs are not actually available to the people that work in the community because the community doesn't have the skill set that is required to get those jobs. And so that's the type of like broader thinking and forward thinking that communities really need to be doing.
And let me say, like Jen and Cynthia are saying, look to the future, you know, we're doing, and the future is a very exciting time. Like if we look to the past, there was limited things that could be done where the tribes were in the rural areas. But now we all went through COVID, right? And we all know that we could do our high tech job anywhere. All we need is a high speed internet connection. We don't have to go to an office once a week. Every day in the week. We could go once a week. We could go twice a month or something. We also have a lot more economic activity in tribes. We have all these casinos now that mm-hmm. are, and then you have, to, which brings people in, and then you have to feed them. You need a place for them to stay. And the future is very bright in tribal areas. There's all these opportunities there. We just got to figure out what we want to do, you know, we being the tribe, what our tribe wants to do. You know, if you're a young tribal person who's getting an education, you don't have to leave the tribe anymore. You don't have to leave your village. I was just with the Kiowa, and they said they have 15,000 enrollment, but half of them aren't in with the rest of the tribe. But that doesn't have to be the future, you know, or maybe I could be the tribe, especially a lot of jobs in the modern economy. We could afford two homes. I could afford one home in with my tribe, with my ancestral homeland. And then I could afford another home somewhere else when I'm doing my high tech job or something.
Yeah, definitely. Well, all right. Let's talk about a plug for Tribal Tab or how to get technical assistance so that our listeners know where to go.
Okay, well, one of the things that we've said on all of our podcasts is that Tribal Tab is available to all tribes. We also work with partners up in Alaska, and EPA pays for that technical assistance, so it's free. And you can get a hold of us by going to our website, that's ksutab.org, ksutab.org, /tribal. And we have our contact information there, and we have the links to things like our brownfield inventory tool and other support tools there.
Awesome. And is that where we can also find Jen? Because I love this holistic approach. Well, thank you all for being here in today's episode and having this conversation with us and our listeners. Jen, Eugene, and Cynthia, definitely appreciate your time. Thank you, thank you. With that brings us to the end of today's episode. So for our listeners, thanks for joining us and listening to the episode today. We hope you enjoyed today's episode, and thanks for always listening to the Hope a Thing a podcast. If that's what you're doing on a regular basis, we definitely appreciate you. Make sure you rate and review us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Google, and visit our website www.nativelearningcenter.com to find information on upcoming webinars, virtual trainings, and future podcast episodes. So with that, hope you all have a wonderful day, night, afternoon, whatever time of day you're listening to this episode, and we'll catch you on the next one. So bye!